So first of all, I would like to give you an overview of my presentation. So at the beginning, I will motivate my research area. So it's based on the anti-symmetry of N-fermion states, Pauli principle, and this aspect. And I can translate these questions into a mathematical problem that was solved just a few years ago. And the solution was found by a mathematician. His name is Alexander Klyachko. And it leads to the so-called generalized Pauli constraints, generalizing the exclusion principle. And in my research, the question is, what can we do with this mathematical structure? Does it have an implication for physics? So for this, I should first of all try to find out how nature looks like. So I started a concrete physical model, so solved this model, and then used the results from that model and checked these generalized Pauli constraints. And it turns out that these constraints are approximatively saturated. So we call it pinning, do an analysis of pinning, and then in the last part of my talk, I will tell you why this effect of pinning has strong physical relevance. So in 1925, by studying electronic transitions in atoms, so Pauli has formulated his famous exclusion principle, which states that given two identical fermions, they can never ever sit in the same one-particle quantum state. Or mathematically, you can say that for a concrete state I, okay, so labeled by index I, the corresponding occupation number is bounded, it cannot exceed the value 1, so it's limited to this interval from 0 to 1. You all know that for some systems, this constraint is very relevant. It's relevant whenever, for a given state I, you observe ni close to 1, to 0 or to 1. I would like to introduce a notation for that. I would like to say, if ni is equal to 0 or close to 0, I would like to say that ni is pinned by this inequality to its minimum 0, or if ni is approximately 1 or exactly 1, I would like to say that ni is quasi-pinned or pinned by this inequality to the other extremum. So the physical relevance of this exclusion principle can be, for example, be seen in the Aufbau principle, which explains the structure of atoms in a very primitive way. So take the one particle energy shells, so this of all spin multiplicity, and then you can fill the energy shells and understand the most basic aspects of atoms, so the general properties, the main properties of atoms. So it's very simple and quite relevant. So 1 year later, in 1926, this Pauli exclusion principle was identified by Dirac and Heisenberg, and maybe also Wigner, as a consequence of a much deeper statement, namely the anti-symmetry of the N-fermion state. So if you swap the two particle coordinates, the wave function, the N-fermion wave function, you get the global minus sign. You all know that this anti-symmetry is a stronger condition than the Pauli exclusion principle. It implies the exclusion principle, but the converse does not hold there. So the natural question arising here is, this here, what are there more implications for the occupation numbers? Are there further restrictions beyond the Pauli exclusion principle? Are these NIs more restricted? Are they restricted to a smaller area? That's the question arising here.
Is it NI is average?
Excuse me?
NI is average?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's average of some operator.
Yeah. And so only very naively speaking, assume that there are more restrictions, more inequalities of that type. You would say that they seem to be relevant whenever they are saturated. So that's, we will make this concrete later. So that's our intuition. So now I would like to, at the beginning, I would like to introduce the mathematical language and the different levels that we will consider here. On the one hand, we can start with a complete picture. So we can consider N-fermions. Okay, so the particle number is always fixed here. So N-fermions, and we describe it by quantum state, which is anti-symmetric on the particle exchange. Or if you like, you can also consider the density operator, a more general picture. In a rank one operator. And for some interest, we might be only interested in one particle properties. So like, for example, the electron density in an atom, or also occupation numbers, also one particle properties. In that case, you can restrict to a much simpler object, to the so-called one particle density operator, the one particle diffuse density operator. You take this guy here and trace out n minus one electrons. So it's irrelevant which n minus one you take due to the symmetry. And then after all, we would like to normalize this guy to the particle number. some normalization. And for my research, the natural object are the eigenvalues of this operator. They're often called natural occupation numbers, also in quantum chemistry. So the eigenvalues of row one, I always denote them by lambda one, lambda two, and so on. And I collect all of them to a vector, lambda vector. And here in my talk, actually, due to mathematical reason, we always restrict to finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So you can always think about an atom with finitely many energy modes. And that's physically, it can be justified from physical reasons due to energy reason. And you need it for mathematics at the end. So lambda vector.
But to define the row one this way, you have to assume that the total Hilbert space is for this kind of structure, which is the one electron Hilbert space.
Exactly.
Is n minus one. But the fermion Hilbert space don't have that structure. Does that make it difficult to define this? If a total Hilbert space have a product structure,
you
can trace part of it.
Yeah, but here it's also possible. I mean, the anti-symmetric Hilbert space, you can embed it into an n-particle Hilbert space. And
I see,
you can
expect it first.
Exactly. And then you can trace out n minus 1.
Okay.
And actually, it's irrelevant which n minus 1 you take. So there's only one particle distance operator, and it's well defined. Actually, I can write it down.
This can be tricky because you may also describe a fermion using symmetric wave function, totally symmetric wave function.
Fermion, do you mean?
Yeah, you take a basis, because a fermion in terms of occupation number, it's choice of phase. You can choose a phase so that the fermion wave function totally symmetric.
So I'm a little bit confused. So I would like to restrict to anti-symmetric states.
Either way.
Oh.
You can use totally symmetric wave function to describe fermion, or you can use totally anti-symmetric wave function to describe fermion.
Yeah. So I would like to restrict to the anti-symmetric states.
I see.
I can define.
I just wonder the different choice whether gave you a different. Different row one and different physics.
I mean, the anti-symmetry is essential. So without anti-symmetry, but with symmetry, there's no story. There's nothing to do here anymore. So the anti-symmetry is relevant, and this picture of anti-symmetric states.
The reason I ask is because you can have hardcore bosons, which in the real space, no two bosons occupy the same site.
Okay. Yeah.
So then in that basis, the hardcore boson and the fermion in some sense similar.
And
whether that would give you something.
Okay. That's a nice point.
Okay.
And actually, you can express to one part with density operator and second quantization.
Okay.
So I think you can write like you introduce a one particle basis, states I, and then creation only relation operators. And I think you need not from the tracer. Okay, so this lambda vector is then the natural object from my presentation. And the question that I addressed on the previous slide can be formulated in a different way. Somehow the goal here is, at the beginning, to translate the anti-symmetry of the n-fermion state to the one particle picture. Go from that level to the simplified level here. Okay, or to translate the anti-symmetry to the language of occupation numbers. Which we can also formulate in a third way. So consider an arbitrary state psi n, so we can determine the row one, the corresponding. And we can do it for all anti-symmetric states, okay, for the family of all of those states, and get the family of all corresponding one-particle reduced density operators. And the question is now, which density operators belong to the set here? Does every density operator belong to the set? So clearly not. It's clear that the Pauli exclusion principle should hold. So from that point of view, the Pauli exclusion principle, which can be formulated here in a more elegant way, every eigenvalue is bounded by 0 and 1. From that statement, it's clear that this set is non-trivial. And the goal is now to describe the set in an elegant way.
So less than 1 year is after multiplying by n by the particle.
Exactly. That's relevant. So we normalized the sum of all these lambda i's to the particle number n. That's exactly the Pauli exclusion principle formulated in this elegant way of eigenvalues of natural occupation numbers. And actually, this year is also this problem here that we are investigating here has a name. It's a one-body fermionic quantum Martian problem. So we're talking about quantum objects. The one density operators are called Martians. Okay, and we ask which density operators here are compatible to n fermion state zone if the anti-symmetry fermion case.
So what's the trace of rho 1 if that's a 1 or n? I saw that I'm just confused because if that's density operator, its trace equal to 1.
We would like to
so
trace it to n.
So the value will be less than 1. So
we choose a different normalization.
Okay.
We normalize it to particle number n. So it's not the standard physical one, it's called
a
quantum chemical. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I see. Under such normalization,
then it's true. Yeah. Exactly. In that sense, if you normalize the rho ones as we do to the particle number, it also makes sense to call them occupation numbers, natural occupation numbers. So to describe the set of rho ones, okay, we should observe the following. There's a unitary equivalent. Given a rho 1, which belongs to this set, okay, so it arises from an anti-symmetric state psi n, then you can infer from that for every unitary operator, that take a unitary operator u, multiply from the left to rho 1, and then u dagger from the right side, okay, this is again a density operator, this guy can arise from this anti-symmetric wave function. This means if rho 1 belongs to the set of possible rho 1s, then also this density operator belongs to it. So the set of possible rho ones is described by spectral information only. This means we only have to care about the lambda vector. There's one annoying point. OK, it's clear, but it turns out to be quite annoying. The solution of the set, the description of the set, highly depends on the number n of fermions and the dimension d of the one particle Hilbert space H1. And the set is becoming very difficult if you increase n and d. And by increase, I mean going from 3 or 4 fermions to 10. That's already difficult. And this is also the reason at the end why I would like to consider essentially smaller settings of 3 fermions and 4 and so on. So the solution of this general problem here was found by Alexander Klyachko just a few years ago. A quite impressive mathematical work that he did. So his result is the following. The set of all possible lambda vectors is first of all convex, so this manifest non-trivial. Second point is it's not only convex, but it's also a polytope, a high-dimensional polytope in this Euclidean space R to the D. So we have D lambdas, okay? So it's a subset of R to the D. It has finitely many extremal points, finitely many facets which describe this polytope. That's very difficult from a mathematical point of view to prove this. And after all, he also provides an algorithm for every fixed n and d to determine this polytope. So I would like to show you how to describe a polytope. I think you know it from your school time. So this is high-dimensional Euclidean space, so of all these lambda vectors. And this is a schematical two-dimensional picture, lambda j, lambda I. And this is a polytope, high-dimensional. So take one facet, for example, this one here. It gives rise to a hypersurface of co-dimension 1. And then you can consider all lambda vectors below that hypersurface. And do the same with this facet, and so on. So in that way, we can say polytope is an intersection of finitely many half spaces. And how do we describe half spaces and hypersurfaces? We know from our school time, the hypersurface, the red area here, is described by such a linear equality, linear in this Cartesian coordinates lambda 1 up to lambda d. And the corresponding half space below or above it is then an inequality, the same term here, then smaller equal than the constant. So this means the solution of this problem, this Martian problem, is a finite family of such linear inequality. So that's the point. And to give you an impression how spectacular the solution is and how much it strengthens the Pauli exclusion principle, let's have a look at this primitive example. So 3 fermions, for example, the lithium atom with 7 modes. Let's have a look at how these generalized Pauli constraints look like. So how is the polytope defined? First of all, there are some trivial constraints, which are not relevant for us, but they also play a role. We would like to arrange these natural occupation numbers in decreasing order. Lambda 1 is the largest, lambda 2 the second largest, and so on, and this lambda 7 is non-negative. Moreover, we normalize it. The sum of all lambdas is equal to the particle number. So here, n equals 3. Now the non-trivial constraints, the generalized Pauli constraint. There are four of them. Okay, have a look at one of them, so it's not relevant how they look like. So here, this one, the sum of the two largest natural occupation numbers plus the fifth largest plus the sixth largest, smaller equal than 2. So you see, it's non-trivial. If there were 3, then it would be trivial. Also, actually, 2.5 would also be trivial, but 2 is non-trivial. And you can really forget about deriving this by your own one weekend. It's you can't believe it how difficult this is. It looks so simple, but it's at the end quite difficult. Piaggio found this just a few years ago, 2008.
But whether every point satisfies this condition is representable.
Yeah, exactly. This necessary and sufficient. Exactly. Okay, to summarize this, so let's have again a look for the set of all possible lambda vectors. Okay, we would like to describe them. In this primitive picture, every point in this here is a lambda vector. We of course know that only lambda vectors are possible which are fulfilling the Pauli exclusion principle. So lambda vector has to lie in the Pauli exclusion principle hypercube here, in this light gray area. But you know, there are further restrictions on this lambda vector coming from the anti-symmetry. So it's the polytope. Every point in the polytope is mathematically possible. You can find a corresponding psi m. Every point here, for example, is mathematically impossible, although it fulfills the exclusion principle. So far, it's only mathematics. Mathematical structure, very beautiful. For me, the question was, what's the relevance of this structure? Can we use it to understand physical systems? And before starting analyzing this question, we should first get intuition for nature. How does nature look like? For this, the goal is somehow take a concrete physical model that's interesting and choose an important state of that model, like the ground state. Okay, then translate this ground state to this picture of occupation numbers, determine the corresponding lambda vector, and check its position inside of the polytope. One state that you know quite well is the state of a single Slater determinant. So psi n, let's say it's a Slater determinant, that's my notation, take n states, 1, 2, n, and then anti-symmetrize it. Okay, it's a Slater determinant here. The corresponding one particle reduced density operator, it's a projection operator exactly on those n states, and the natural occupation numbers are n times 1 and then some zeros. In this schematical picture, this state here corresponds to this red dot here. Of course, it's a part of the polytope because you know there exists such a psi n. And you know that this state has some meaning. So if you consider n fermions that do not interact, then that's the ground state. For non-interacting fermions, you only have to solve the one particle eigenvalue equation and get some energy shells. So one particle energy shells. And you fill these energy shells with the electrons. And that's in the ground state. It's exactly one Slater determinant. So if we only consider ground states for non-interacting systems, you already know that we are here at that point. And now the question is, what happens if you switch on interaction between the fermions? Does the point go more to the middle of the polytope, or is it exactly on the boundary? And we say it's pinned to the boundary. That's the question that we would like to analyze here. And one aspect, why is it so interesting to have pinning? Point is, if you have pinning, you know one thing for sure, that if you switch on a unitary time evolution for this point generated by an external field or whatever, you know that this point can never ever leave the polytope. And for some very specific time evolutions that would like to push the point out of the polytope, you know that this is not possible. So in that case, some parts of the time evolution are determined by the geometry of the polytope. So it's kinematical, it's not dynamical anymore. In that case, you can say the corresponding generalized Pauli constraint is turning into an equality. And this inequality might then describe kinematics, so it's a kinematical constraint. That's actually a generalization of this picture that you all know. So for atoms, you can couple these electronic systems to photons. Okay, then it's possible that some electrons decay. But here, it's not possible due to the Pauli exclusion principle. This cannot decay, this electron here. Or the same for solid bodies at low temperature. You know that the physics is determined by the electrons close to the Fermi level, because the very low electrons cannot be pushed to the higher levels by small heat quantum. So that's a generalization, this picture here of that. So now let's have a look at nature. How does nature look like? You should look for a model and do the whole analysis. But that's not so easy at the end, because first of all, we would like to consider n and fermions that interact. So there's a coupling between the fermions delta. I would like to do the whole work analytical. So this means, first of all, I would like to be able to determine the n fermion ground state. And for generic systems, that's impossible. But that's not enough. I would like to determine in a second non-trivial step the one particle reduced density operator. This means I should trace out n minus 1 fermions. So this means effectively calculating some integrals, for example. It's not trivial. And in a third non-trivial step, we should determine the eigenvalue. So we have three non-trivial steps. And typically, you can forget about doing this. But fortunately, there's maybe exactly one model, one continuous model for which you can do this, and a model that we all studied during our studies, namely n particles, here in one dimension, okay, so n particles, one dimension. Xi are the spatial coordinates of these n particles, and the particles are in a harmonic trap, okay, so, and they interact with each other by a harmonic coupling, okay. So there's a coupling strength d between the fermions, between the particles, and the external potential m omega squared. These are the two length scales, energy scales for this model. So we can summarize this Hamiltonian. We can write it as kinetic energy plus a coupling term, and this is, can be chosen as symmetric coupling matrix. So it's a quadratic form, and we all solve this very easy way. We can interpret this, first of all, as Hamiltonian on an n-fermion, on an n-particle space, and on that space, we can easily solve the eigenvalue problem. We diagonalize m, okay, and at the end we end up with a harmonic oscillator for the center of mass motion, a length scale L, and n minus one harmonic oscillators all decoupled from each other for the relative excitation of the length scale L tilde. The only important information from here is you should remember that there are two length scales, L and L tilde, and for zero interaction, they are identical. That's the important thing. So the regime of weak interaction is characterized by L is approximately equal to L tilde. Okay, this reason why I introduced this. But now to study this fermionic quantum margin problem, the generalized Pauli constraints, we should restrict to the anti-symmetric state. It means consider to the wave functions of n fermions on the one particle Hilbert space, which are anti-symmetric. And then it's not that easy anymore to determine the ground state. So in 2011, there was a paper which presented how the ground state looked like. Actually, the paper was published 2 weeks after I also found it on a sheet of paper. So I began to worry. I thought some other guys would like to do exactly the same as I planned to do. At the end, it turned out that the physicists, they had some different intention. Okay. So the ground state is presented here. Let's have a very short look at it. Okay. There are two main parts. Here, it's the Fundament determinant, so it's anti-symmetric on the particle exchange, and the remaining part should be symmetric. And yes, that's true. Okay, so you see here, x1 up to xn, and here x vector, so it's symmetric on the particle exchange. One comment: you can also solve the problem, after all, much easier in this Hilbert space, and you get exactly the same state, but without the Fundament determinant. That's symmetric, so it's also the bosonic ground state. So the differences between the fermions and bosons is hidden in the Fundament determinant in this model here. Okay. So then we can trace out n minus 1 fermions. Okay, it's not so difficult. Oh, okay, one comment. For zero interaction, I told you L and L tilde are identical. So this vanishes. This separates here into a product of exponential functions. And you see it's exactly a Slater determinant as it should be, since this is the Fundament determinant. So let's trace out n minus 1 fermions. So only the structure is important, and even the structure is not that important, but you get an exponential function times a polynomial. So by going from fermions to bosons, polynomial would vanish. Okay? So unfortunately, I think it's not possible to diagonalize this density kernel. So it's too difficult. Actually, without this polynomial, it would be possible because this exponential function here is exactly the Euclidean Feynman propagator for the harmonic oscillator. But due to this polynomial, it's not possible anymore. And to get the important information, first of all, I resorted to numerical methods. Okay, I chose a one-particle basis, a one-particle Hilbert space, namely exactly the bosonic basis, and I can got easy to determine. And then I translated this guy here, this density kernel, to a matrix, the infinite times infinite matrix. I did it for a concrete delta, for a concrete D, for concrete interaction strength. They plugged this matrix into the computer, truncated it after 1,000 rows and columns, and the computer gave the lambda vector to me, the approximate lambda vector. And the truncation effect is incredibly small. You cannot believe it. It's so small. You can really say I found all the results by numerics. But then, of course, I was very ambitious and tried to get it analytically by perturbation theory, at least the leading orders. So I took this here as kernel of a density operator, or somehow as Hamiltonian, okay, this guy here, as function of the interaction strength between the fermions. For zero interaction strength, you know the spectrum of this guy. It's n times 1, then infinitely many times 0. Then switch on the interaction, perform perturbation theory. And actually, the funny thing is, it turns out that almost all textbooks are wrong. I mean, if they present perturbation theory for the general cases, they seem to be wrong. And only the one of Jürg Fröhlich, of my former supervisor, was correct. I checked maybe 10 or 15 books. It's unbelievable. Some 50% have a wrong assumption, and the other 50% provide an algorithm which doesn't work. So that's quite shocking for me. So I got lambda vector, okay? That's the story, okay? So we have lambda vector. And what are the properties of this lambda vector? First of all, you can easily see that only the ratio between the two energy scales are relevant for this lambda vector. Okay. This means nothing else but the ratio of these two length scales. From now on, I'd like to restrict to n equals 3. So for n equals 3, it's much easier to determine all this stuff. For n equals 4, you have to trace out more fermions and so on. And after all, the polytope is becoming very difficult. So let's consider n equals 3. Maybe later I can also tell you that for n equals 2, there's no polytope. Okay. For n equals 3, I found a model-specific non-trivial duality. Lambda vectors function of this ratio, so consider this here, and then take the inverse of this ratio. And you see both lambda vectors are identical. So you can summarize it somehow, but this duality connects the repulsive and attractive interaction regime between both fermions. If you take the inverse of this ratio, you go from attractive to repulsive interaction. And it's, of course, model specific. And I call it non-trivial, because if I study the end-fermion state, I it's not so easy to see this duality. I cannot see it. But on the one-particle level, it's quite obvious. So it's somehow a little bit hidden on the n-particle level. And the reason why I tell you this is that this simplifies my perturbation theory. I can define a very appropriate interaction strength. I define e to minus delta, delta is a new quantity, as the ratio of these two guys. Okay, this means nothing else than that, but that lambda as function of delta is symmetric. Okay? So by doing perturbation theory in delta, you know that all odd terms in delta should vanish. And for you, the important point is now, the weak interaction regime corresponds to delta close to zero. That's the point. So the complete results, we find a decay behavior, lambda k as e to minus gamma k for k large. This decay behavior is, for technical reasons, important, as you will see later. And the concrete results are this. Remember, we consider three fermions, okay? Lambda 1 is the largest eigenvalue, so the difference 1 minus lambda 1, 1 minus lambda 2, 1 minus lambda 3. For delta small, these differences are very small. So this means these three guys are very close to 1, so close to the Hartree-Fock point. Due to normalization, it's clear that all the other lambdas should be then very small. Delta to 4, delta to 4, delta 6, delta 8, delta 10. And yes, there's a hierarchy. For k large enough, large equal 5, going from k to k plus 1, you get two additional deltas. So it means the lambda k's are decaying quite fast. Okay. So now we take these guys here and check the position inside of the polytope as function of delta. So that this was our plan to do this. But now you should say, just insist that that's not possible anymore here. The problem is, I told you we should restrict to finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. But here, the Hilbert space, the one part of the Hilbert space is L2 of R, the square integral function that's infinite dimensional. That's a big problem. The problem is, first of all, that this solution set here, of course, you can talk about this mathematical object in principle. But first of all, it's not known yet. And if it were known, it would be too difficult to describe it. That's clear, that's too difficult. It's infinite dimensional, and there will be so many constraints on this set. So that's one mathematical trick. I will tell you how it works, and then I will tell you that it should work again. What you do is consider only the largest d eigenvalues, okay? Take these d numbers and plug them into the generalized Pauli constraints of this artificial setting. So far, it has nothing to do with the correct setting. Okay, and then you see whether the constraints are saturated or approximatively saturated or not saturated at all. And the statement is, here you can trust me, I can prove this. The statement is, if you're very close to the boundary of this artificial polytope, this truncated information, then you can conclude from that you're also close to the boundary of this unknown polytope. Well, actually, the word polytope doesn't make sense anymore. You're very close to the boundary of this set, modulo an error of truncation. And you saw before, we have this hierarchy. These lambda k's are decaying quite rapidly. So you can see that I can choose delta small enough such that this error is very small. Okay, at the end, we have to be a little more careful than here, but we have to compare different orders in deltas. But that's the main story. So what I will do in the following, I will truncate this here and check smaller settings, okay, and determine the position in these artificial settings. The first non-trivial setting is this here. So we have three fermions and a six-dimensional one-particle Hilbert space, so the six modes. The polytope was already known some decades ago. It was found by Borland and Dennis and Maribel Sruskaj by brute force calculation. Okay. Here it's so simple that it was possible by a very high effort to derive these constraints. I'd like to introduce them to you. So here we have six eigenvalues, lambda 1 up to lambda 6. And one constraint is the largest and the smallest eigenvalue is equal to 1. The second largest and second smallest is equal to 1. And the two guys in the middle are also equal to 1. That's actually very special for this setting, that some inequalities are turning into equalities. Typically, for larger settings, you only have inequalities. So here you can interpret this as two inequalities that becoming one inequality. And there's one real inequality, namely the sum of the two smallest eigenvalues minus the fourth largest is non-negative. So you see again how non-trivial this is. And in the following, due to this equality, I can simplify the analysis a little bit. The polytope is a three-dimensional polytope, okay, due to the three equalities here. And I take lambda 4, lambda 5, and lambda 6 as independent variables. So this is my three-dimensional vector here. And I ask for this vector as function of the interacting strength delta. So let's have a look at the polytope, okay? That's the boundary of the polytope, but only a part of it. It's the neighborhood of the Hartree-Fock point. So this vector VA vector here is the Hartree-Fock point. So we know that this vector here, for zero interaction, for delta equals zero, is exactly at that point here. And now let's switch on delta, and we will find this black trajectory here. On a scale delta to the 4, you will see that this point will leave the Hartree-Fock point and will move approximately on this edge here, this polytope. On a finer scale, delta to the 6, this point, this trajectory will also leave this edge here, but will move to the right. But it's still on this bottom area. And this bottom area is the interesting area here in this picture. Because this bottom area here, this two-dimensional facet here, corresponds to saturation of this inequality. That's actually what we are investigating here. Is this constraint saturated or not? This is somehow, we only have to know the distance of the black trajectory to this bottom area. And on a scale delta to the 6, we are exactly on the bottom area. So on delta to the 6, we have saturated this here. And plugging in the concrete results, we will see this here. D6 of delta, it should be non-negative, okay, behaves as delta to the 8. That's the result. So that's the result that we find by plugging in the lambdas. So now the point is, that's not the correct setting. That's only artificial so far. This setting is the correct one as long as we can neglect the seventh largest eigenvalue. But the seventh largest eigenvalue, lambda 7, behaves as delta to the 8. So you see, the truncation error, delta to the 8, has the same order as the distance to the boundary. So far, we found the following result. We found that we are at least very close to boundary, at least with delta to the 8. It's not clear whether we're exactly on the boundary or not, but we already know that we are very, very close to it, delta to the 8. So to improve this, we should take another eigenvalue into account, lambda 7, okay? So consider this setting here, mod 1, 7 eigenvalues. You already saw these inequalities, okay, and make it short, we see that these four non-trivial inequalities, these four non-trivial terms, they behave all as delta to the 8 again. This setting here is correct as long as you can neglect lambda 8. Lambda 8 behaves as delta to the 10. So the truncation error is smaller than the distance to the boundary, and the whole pinning analysis is already finished. Our result is quasi-pinning. We are not exactly on the boundary, but given that, we are incredibly close to it, delta to the 8. And so far, it seems to be a result which holds for only very weak interaction. But if you do computer simulations, you can also see that for quite large deltas, you're also very close to the boundary. So you can also plug in 1/2 or 0.7, and this is not the very weak interaction regime. It's maybe middle strong interaction regime, and you're still very close to it. So that's the result. It's quite nice to be so close to the boundary. And now the natural question is, what does it mean to be close to the boundary? Is there a physical relevance of this? Okay. And now, in the last part of my talk, I will explain to you, yes, fortunately, there is a meaning for that. It has an implication. Unfortunately, we have to introduce a little bit notation and some mathematical concept. Not very advanced, but slightly technical. Consider an arbitrary generalized Pauli constraint. So you know it's a linear constraint, so there's lambda 1 up to lambda d, and it's larger or equal than 0. Now assume there's a state given, psi m, which leads to natural occupation numbers lambda 0 vector. And assume that this lambda 0 vector saturates this constraint, which means d of lambda 0 is equal to 0. The question is, what does this mean for psi n, for the psi n which leads to this lambda 0 vector? So that's the question about physical relevance of pinning. And I will tell you now that you can conclude something for that state out of pinning. To give you an impression how it will work, or about the character of this statement, is have a look at this here. Assume I tell you for a concrete physical state, the natural occupation numbers are all either 1 or 0. And then the goal is determine the structure of the n-fermion state. You already know how it should look like. You can prove that such a spectrum has to arise from a single state determinant state. Of course, you do not know how the one particle states 1 up to n look like, but you know that by choosing the appropriate 1 up to n, you can write psi n as one single state determinant. The good thing with that statement is that it's stable under small deviations, which means that if lambda vector is approximately 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, you know that the corresponding state psi n by choosing the appropriate basis is approximately one single state determinant. This is somehow the reason why Hartree-Fock can work for certain systems, if the stability of that statement. And now I will present a generalization of that statement. Assume there's a concrete state given, okay? Maybe you don't know this state because it's too difficult to determine it, but God knows this state, so it's a ground state of a concrete system, for example. Let's say it's psi n, okay? For this state psi n, one can, in principle, determine corresponding one part of the reduced density operator, diagonalize it, so it means write it as natural occupation number times the eigenvectors, okay? Projection operator on the eigenspaces. And we call them natural orbitals, the eigenvectors, yeah. And these natural orbitals, they define one particle basis, one particle hyperspace. Okay, so all these I's here. This basis gives rise to a corresponding natural n particle basis. I mean this here. Take n of those guys here, so I1, tensor, and so on up to IM, and then anti-symmetrize this guy here. Okay, this is an Slater determinant, and I denote it by I bar here, by this symbol. That's the Slater determinant. And this here, then a tuple of n variables, I1 up to IN. That's then a basis for the n-fermion Hilbert space. So this concrete psi n can, of course, be expanded with respect to spaces. Okay, we can write it as a linear combination of complex numbers and Slater determinants. And of course, it's clear that these quantities depend on psi n, but implicitly. But nevertheless, we can do this. Okay. So now, let's go back to this marginal constraint, to this generalized Pauli constraint, which is saturated by lambda zero vector. For this constraint, I would like to define a mathematical operator which depends on psi implicitly. It's a little bit difficult, but it's, have a look at it. Take kappa zero, write it here, and multiply it with the identity, okay? Then take this here, kappa one, then replace this number lambda one by the particle number of the first natural orbital. So it's the creation and annihilation operator of a fermion in the first natural orbital. Then do the same with the next term up to the last one, okay? Kappa d, then ad dagger ad. That's a density operator. Okay? One comment, all these parts here, these operators that we sum up here, they all commute with each other. Okay? That's important later. And now the mathematical statement is, okay, maybe we can summarize this. If this psi n, okay, we would like to make a statement on psi n. This psi n leads to a lambda vector, lambda zero vector, which saturates this constraint. And then we can define such a d operator, which implicitly depends on psi n. And that's the mathematical statement which holds it. Psi m, the state psi m, which leads to pinning, is an eigenvector of this operator d hat, and it has eigenvalue 0. That's the statement. That's a quite powerful statement, as you will see in the next line. After all, you can plug in the concrete expression for psi m, okay? It's in the linear combination of all these i's, the coefficient c i's, and then here the slate determines it. You can maybe already imagine that determining this guy here is quite easy. D hat times E tilde can easily be determined because these later determinants are the eigenvectors of D hat. That's quite obvious due to the fact that they are commuting and so on. And D hat is exactly constructed in that way, and I prime also. So now assume, okay, we can easily determine this here. So the only thing that you have to do is ask which numbers are contained in this later determinant, okay, here. Then consider this guy here, and ask, is the state I contained in this later determinant here, yes or no? If it's contained, you add a value 1 here, you replace this by 1. And if it's not contained, you replace it by 0. Then you do this for all orbitals up to d, and this term is exactly the eigenvalue that should show up on the right side here. Okay, and it might be 0 or it's not 0. And whenever it's not 0, due to this statement here, you can conclude this here. Whenever this here is non-zero, which happens quite often, okay, then you can conclude that the corresponding coefficient has to vanish. That's a selection rule of Slater determinants. And to show you how powerful this is, let's have a look at this quite simple setting. 3 fermions and 6 modes. So this Hilbert space has dimension 6 over 3, so it's 20 dimensional. Assume that the only inequality that we have is saturated. The corresponding psi m necessarily has this structure here. It's a linear combination of only 3 Slater determinants instead of 20, namely exactly those 3 guys. So this is a substructure, as you can see. So the state 1 shows up twice, the state 2 also. So it's quite spectacular. So you see the pinning is somehow caused only by states, or pinning corresponds only to states which significantly simpler structure. And now,
what do you mean by pinning here? I said before, you say the pinning means the lambda near the boundary.
Exactly. So.
But what's pinning for D? That's a different thing or the same thing?
I mean, that's the inequality. We assume there's I give you a lambda vector, and you plug it into this equation, and you find that this approximate here for 0 or equal to 0. Let's assume it's equal to 0, okay?
Okay.
And then I ask you, what's the structure of the corresponding psi 3? Which 3 particle states can lead to this lambda vector which pins this here? And then you can directly tell me it necessarily has the structure.
Yeah. But this
is also stable under small deviations.
Then there's an issue about why you have a pinning mean. What I'm trying to say is that when you have a many body state with some interaction, the ground state may not have this structure.
Yeah, that's possible.
Means it's not pinning.
Exactly. Yeah, that's possible. But I can tell you some more things in the next slide or second. I mean, what you know for this model that I consider, you have pinning. I mean, very strong pinning up to delta to the 8.
Okay.
It's one model, but. But of course, the general.
It's a harmonic oscillator model.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Okay. Of course, if you have a different model, it,
so
it might look different.
The harmonic oscillator model have a pinning.
Yeah, it's very strong pinning.
The
small errors, only small distance.
Even without error, I mean, just that harmonic oscillator model.
Yeah.
Whether that model have a precise pinning?
Not precise. The error is delta to the eta. So we are not
the
exactly on the bound.
What is delta? What is delta?
So delta is linear in D, actually. D over M omega squared. So in the regime of weak interaction, they are linear, approximately. Yeah, that's a good point.
So delta represents interaction.
Exactly. Delta is approximately D.
So without interaction,
you are exactly the boundary. Exactly.
So when you're telling interaction, it'd be away from the boundary.
Yeah, but you're very close to it. Delta to the 8, it's surprisingly closer.
Yeah, but if can delta be of order 1?
Yeah, I mean
yeah,
you didn't see it from my analytical results, but
see.
If you plug in the computer, if you choose delta equal 1, distance and boundary, I don't remember the results, but maybe it's 1, 10 to minus 6 or whatever. So
oh, I see.
10 minus 4.
Okay.
And your distance to the Hartree-Fock point is much larger. So, I mean, the Hartree-Fock point is close to the, it's on the boundary. So, if your state is close to state determinant, pinning is boring. I mean, but it's the important point is that you're much closer to the boundary than to this very specific point on the boundary, to the Hartree-Fock point. Of course, here we checked only one model, okay, so far. We found for this model pinning. Of course, we might have models without pinning, and then the state has not this structure. But whenever you find pinning, you have such a structure. So pinning has physical relevance. So pinning corresponds to specific structures. Okay, and one application is we can suggest a Hartree-Fock improvement. So the goal is consider an N-fermion model and assume we cannot solve the eigenvalue problem, which is quite natural, okay? And then approximate the ground state energy, ground state properties. So let's say we consider three fermions, and I can present this nice picture again to you, the polytope three fermion setting. So Hartree-Fock means we allow only three particle states which correspond to this vertex here of the polytope. This means if we take three one particle states, so one to three, okay, in our D dimension one particle base, determine the energy expectation, and then rotate these three basis states, one to three, in our one particle basis, okay, and ask, look for the minimum, energetic minimum. That's our Hartree-Fock ground state. But this is quite limited, because we restrict to this point here, and assume that your concrete ground state, the exact ground state, is here, okay, and you're very far away from that point. So in that case, Hartree-Fock does not lead to the correct ground state. But an improvement of that, it's clearly an improvement, because it's more complicated, okay? Take this state, psi 3, which corresponds to pinning by this constraint here, which corresponds to this bottom area. For this harmonic oscillator model, that's a fantastic improvement. It improves Hartree-Fock by several orders in delta. It's clear that it improves Hartree-Fock because we can choose beta gamma equal 0, and then we have the same as Hartree-Fock. And after all, the quantum chemical methods went in that direction. So quantum chemists, they optimize ground state for atoms, and they have so-called configuration interaction methods. So they try to approximate ground states, and they add up thousands of state determinants. So our contribution is that we can tell them that we have the impression that we can tell them which state determinants you should add up. So we can choose some very smart guess here. We do not have to add up 10,000 to get a significant improvement, but only three. Yes?
In these numerical methods, how many fermions could you possibly handle? I mean, is it order 10? Is it order 100?
Actually, I don't know it, but the point is you have two parameters. I mean, if you consider only two fermions, like helium, there's another quantity, the dimension of the one particle Hilbert space. And at the end, you always choose the one particle Hilbert space such that you can still handle it. And for larger fermionic systems, you have to choose the one particle Hilbert space so small that it doesn't make sense anymore. But for smaller systems like helium or lithium, you can choose quite big one particle Hilbert space at the end. I think what I can handle is maybe, okay, I'm not sure, but I think maybe 10,000 Clayton determinants of this order. And there are several methods how to do it, different ways of doing configuration to action. And at the end, it depends also very much on the dimension of the one particle Hilbert space. And of course, if you do not know the physical system very well, it's not easy to make an appropriate guess of the one particle Hilbert space. So the quantum chemists, they always choose D one particle orbitals due to some intuition. And that's this basis defines the n particle Hilbert space. And then they sum up maybe all state determinants that you can construct, or some of them, and the different methods. And so here the sum of the statement is that we have the impression that we can choose some very smart state determinants. We can choose them in a very smart way. Okay, and if the system turns out to be close to the boundary here, then we know that it's a perfect approximation. Okay, I would like to conclude. So first, we learned how to translate the anti-symmetry of the enfermion state to the one-particle picture. It was done by Alexander Tyachko, and it led to the so-called generalized Pauli constraint. And you saw that they significantly strengthened Pauli exclusion principle with the Pauli top inside of the hypercube. Then, to get an impression, we studied a concrete model of enfermions that interact with a coupling strength delta. First, we found that the distance to the Hartree-Fock point behaves as delta to 4. So this means Hartree-Fock should work quite well for delta not too large, but for delta a little bit larger, it's not that great anymore. Nevertheless, we also found that the distance to the boundary of the polytope is significantly smaller, by 4 additional orders in delta. So it turns out that we have pinning up to corrections of order delta to 8. So this is very surprising. Okay, and maybe some comments on the general character of this, or generic character. I mean, the model is very primitive, or it has a physical meaning, I think. It's not stupid, it's a good natural model. If a model which is so simple leads to such a surprising result, it's more than a model-specific result. After all, the next slide, on the final slide, I will make some more generic statements. Then we saw that this pinning leads it has a physical relevance, okay, and the ground state has a very specific structure. If you have pinning, and this amounts to an improvement of Hartree-Fock. You can try this as Hartree-Fock extension, and for some models, it will improve Hartree-Fock significantly, and for some not. So it's like Hartree-Fock, you also don't know whether it works or not. And you can summarize this from a different point of view, a little bit provocative maybe. It might be that fermionic ground states are simpler than appreciated, or at least for some models. Okay. Well, I would like to give you an outline to finish this here. I did. Actually, one week ago, or 2 weeks ago, I did some computer simulations. I considered a lattice model, so 7 lattice sites here, and 3 fermions that can hop on that one-dimensional lattice. So these are the fermions, the red dots here. And then I switch on an external potential, xi to the s with some parameter s, s equal to 2, for example, for a harmonic trap. And then I switch on interaction between the fermions, its distance between the fermions to the r. So r equal 2 for harmonic interaction, R equal minus 1 for Coulomb interaction. And there's a fine structure constant or coupling constant delta in front of it. And now the question is, clearly for delta equals 0, we have the Hartree-Fock point, and we're on the boundary. The question is now, what happens for delta larger than 0? OK, and what you find is, because it's continuous, the situation for delta very small, you're also very close to the Hartree-Fock point, also close to the boundary. But what you will find for all R and for all S, you are always, in the regime of weak interaction, always significantly closer to the boundary than to the Hartree-Fock point. And it seems that the distance to the Hartree-Fock point squared is approximately of the same order as the distance to the boundary for all R and S. So in one-dimensional models, it seems that for one-dimensional models with 3 electrons, pinning is generic. As long as there's an external potential which pushes the electrons to one lattice site, as long as the electrons are fighting for the same optimal CT, they seem to be pinning for arbitrary interaction strength.
So for S equal to minus 1, that's like a Coulomb expression. I wonder
Actually, I only chose positive S.
Because of this would be interesting if you do that for 3 dimension,
exactly.
Like lithium atoms.
Yeah.
Then that's you have 1-1 interaction and also 1-1R.
Yeah.
I wonder whether in that case, whether this what situation?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have some results in that. I also considered the Hubbard model, but in not interesting regime with three latticides, one band Hubbard model, three fermions hopping on the three latticides. And for all hopping parameters, all Hubbard parameters, you find exact pinning of the ground setter. Okay, it's due to high symmetry, I expect, so I think it's artificial, maybe. It's not clear yet. But for all hopping parameters and all Hubbard interaction strengths, you're exactly on the boundary. We have also projects in quantum chemistry. We check data. It's not so easy to get these data because the quantum chemists, they're not so crazy about this natural occupation numbers. They play a role there, but they are more interested in different properties. So you cannot find that many results on natural occupation numbers. I mean, they did quite many optimizations with all different ways for several atoms, molecules, and so on. But typically, they do not present the natural occupation numbers. But there's one set of data, and Klyashko found it when he came up with the mathematics. It's a very artificial optimization from, I think, three or four Japanese scientists, they're quantum chemists, and they did some optimization. They considered beryllium, okay? And the one particle basis was defined by the 1s orbital, 2s orbital, 3s, 4s, and 5s. They skipped all p orbitals, d orbitals, and whatever. So it's totally irrelevant for physics. This is also what they claim, but they need this result for some different reasons, okay? But they presented the natural occupation numbers for this result, and Klyashko found them, and he checked inequalities. And actually, this is a very funny story. So they presented six digits in the paper. Klyashko used this result, plugged them in, and he found exact pinning. And 1 week ago, so we found a very nice quantum chemist from Austria, and he's now working with us, and he succeeded in reproducing these numbers from the Japanese, 10 digits. And on the seventh digit, you see corrections to pinning. So this is exactly my intuition. I think you are never on the boundary as long as you have an interesting model with continuous space. So beryllium, with its very artificial state, is very close to the boundary. And we did also some simulation for lithium ground state, and I think we found that we are also very close to the boundary, but it seems to be more or less trivial because we also to the Hartree-Fock point. But it's okay, so far we did not yet answer your question with atoms, okay? But there's some results. Then my goal is to get the physical and mathematical intuition for pinning. There's a similar story for Hartree-Fock. So the question is, when does Hartree-Fock work well? A quantum chemist, very often he's saying, when the so-called homo-lumen gap is very large, then Hartree-Fock works well. Homo is the highest occupied molecular orbital, and lumo, the lowest unoccupied molecular, this one. Intuitively, it's clear if this energy gap is very large, it's one part of the Hartree-Fock picture, then Hartree-Fock should be the correct approximation. And I'm very sure that to understand pinning from a physical and mathematical point of view, you should compare different energies. So some interaction energies between the fermions versus one particle energy distances and so on. So I have no clue how to do it, but I think it should be possible to develop intuition for that by generalizing this here. Then in the future, I would like to apply this to macroscopic systems. We already started a little bit going in this direction. So it's not so easy because the polytope is becoming difficult. So I told you we should restrict to n equals 3 or 4. So now we should go to 10 to 23. That's quite tough. But maybe one can find an approximate description of the polytope. Maybe you can find the inner or outer approximation and find some very specific inequalities which are relevant. And then you can apply it to specific condensed matter problems. So you can, for example, say, well, pinning seems to be natural. So assume the concrete effect that we cannot understand so far or not well enough leads to pinning, and then can write down an answer to the wave function because pinning corresponds to significantly simpler ground state. And my intuition, my general intuitional motivation is this here. So the anti-symmetry is in very strong conflict with the energy minimization in the following sense. If you skip the anti-symmetry, you would find a much lower energy ground state. So this means that somehow the boundary of this polytope, since it arises from the anti-symmetry, should play some role for the ground state. This is my intuition. So I expect that pinning might also show up in macroscopic systems. But it's not so easy to do this. Well, thank you very much.
You know that this a quantum wave function has this property, the cube of a solution determinant.
Okay. Well, Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, the stellar determinant is a Hartree-Fock.
Exactly.
But when you cube it, whether It's certainly far away from 100 foot, but it will be still near the boundary.
Actually, you already asked me this. In Hong Kong, so I just started last week with this. The problem, it seems to be a very easy question and easy to check, but at the end, it's not that easy. Because, I mean, the easiest setting is n equals 3. For n equals 2, there's no polytope. So you should start with n equals 3. And as you said, it's a cube. It's the simplest setting.
Yeah.
So p equals 3, this factor. So you have this fundamental determinant to the 3.
Yeah.
So it's then polynomial of degree 9.
Yeah.
But you take the 3-particle density operator, so it's degree 18.
Okay.
Then you should trace out two variables.
Okay.
And I did it with the computer, and I got 1,000 terms. And I just started to do it systematically. I think I can easily answer it in 1 or 2 weeks.
Okay.
So this is very interesting and important to
now
answer.
This is another class of wave function.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is far away from a stellated determinant, but topological orders, things like that.
So I'm very interested in that direction. That's my first step towards solid state physics. It's very important to answer this question.
More questions? So is there a specific significance for 6? Is that turned out to give you just a nice example?
Okay.
That it didn't have with 5 and still doable?
So for this model, the first reason is we have to compare different orders in delta. So this is the first answer. Later, we'll give you a more general answer. So, I mean, the correct lambda 1 behaved as 1 minus delta to the 6. Or you can show it to you. So you see lambda 1 behaves as 1 minus delta to the 6. And lambda 6 also behaves as delta to the 6. So if I truncate after 5 or 4 dimensions, I made a systematic error, but I can also answer your question in a more general way. So it turns out that the setting with 3 fermions and 6 modes is also the first non-trivial setting. So for this model, it's clear that we cannot start with that. Actually, we can start with 2 electrons in 4 dimensions. Maybe that's the first thing that I should answer. So let's say n is a particle number. For n equals 1, there's nothing to do. There's nothing to reduce, and I think it's boring. Okay. So n equals 2 is the first non-trivial particle number that we can consider. And for that setting here, n equal 2, and arbitrary dimension d of the one particle Hilbert space, there are very strong conditions, restrictions on the natural occupation numbers, lambda vector. The restrictions are that all non-zero eigenvalues are evenly many times degenerate. So you can say lambda 1 is equal to lambda 2, lambda 3 is equal to lambda 4, actually, they also might be equal, okay, these 4 guys, and so on. So all non-zero eigenvalues have to be identical. This follows from Schmidt decomposition. So you can split your 2-particle Hilbert space in 1-particle Hilbert space time. One particle, and then this easily follows due to the anti-symmetry. Okay, so this means we should go to n equals 3. Okay, this is what we did. And now, first of all, okay, so now let's consider, for example, dimension d smaller than 6. So 1, 2, 3 doesn't make sense. 3 may. Doesn't make that much sense. So 1 and 2 is meaningless, and for 3 we have nothing. So let's consider d equal 4, d equal 5. There's one general property, the so-called particle hole duality, which means that this setting so n fermions and d modes, that's isomorphic. And then in the language of this Martian problem, it's all then identical. The same setting where you consider the holes instead of the particles. So now I can directly tell you how the Marshall constraints look like if you know them for this setting.
Okay.
What you do is, okay, from that it's clear that it's equivalent, and so for this here, 3 fermions and 5 modes, it's an equivalent to this Marshall setting to 2 holes. And 5 modes, and 2 modes is boring due to Schmidt decomposition, so we have no volume in the polytope where something can happen. It's maybe interesting to use this information, but there's nothing to check for pinning. Okay, and it's also intuitively, I think it's clear how to get the constraints for that setting if those are given. What you do is take a constraint from that setting, okay, an arbitrary constraint, then replace every lambda, lambda I, by 1 minus lambda I, and then flip the indices, replace lambda d by lambda 1, and so on. This is essentially particle hole duality, right? All of this. So this is the reason why I start with why we always consider n equals 3 and 6 modes is the simplest setting that we have.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay, so let's thank Christian again.